This is the Music History In-Depth podcast for April 9th through the 15th. On this week's show, the Beatles call it quits, but not without some controversy. Marian Anderson performs at the Lincoln Memorial. Tupac returns, sort of. Garth Brooks debuts, and our honorable mentions this week include the birthday of the Empress of the Blues. This show goes more in depth about some of the events that we put on our daily podcast, the Music History Today podcast, which drops every single day, including weekends, wherever you get your podcast from. Now, on to this week's episode. The Beatles were arguably the most influential group in music history. From the way they burst onto the scene, to the way they recorded their music, to the actual music itself, to them becoming the face of the counterculture movement, there was no facet of music and pop culture life that the Beatles didn't touch. It came as a complete shock to their many fans, then, as to what happened on April 10th, 1970. To be honest about it, the Beatles' demise as a group actually began years earlier. Manager Brian Epstein not only guided their careers, but was the glue that kept the four egos together. He, along with producer Sir George Martin, knew them inside and out and knew which buttons to push in order to keep them together. But once Epstein passed away on August 27, 1967, a major part of what held the Beatles together was gone. The band took over their own finances, but didn't know how to really take care of them. They needed some help. Paul McCartney wanted his in-laws, Lee and John Eastman, to take care of the finances, while the rest of the band wanted Alan Klein, who also managed Sam Cooke and the Rolling Stones. Since no one could really agree on who should do it, it was decided that all of them would do it. The Eastmans would be the band's lawyers, and Klein would be their manager. Seems like a pretty fair thing to do. Unfortunately for the band, neither the Eastmans nor Klein worked as a team. There were missed financial opportunities, so something had to be done. The band, against McCartney's objections, fired the Eastmans and let Klein take over everything. Paul was so pissed off that he even refused to sign the management contract. The band was also going through some personal growth. All of them had outside projects. John started putting out solo songs. Among those were Give Peace a Chance and Instant Karma. That and the financial infighting, plus the creative differences that they were having about the group's music, led to John Lennon announcing to the band on September 20th, 1969, that he was leaving the group. He also said that he would not go public with the decision, as it was decided that the band would do one more album together. Also, Yoko Ono was not responsible for the Beatles breaking up, although she probably didn't really help matters any. Pro tip for you kids out there, don't let your girlfriends, boyfriends, wives, or husbands have any say in any matters of your band. It's just not a good idea. Trust me. Anywho, the final album that was recorded was originally called Get Back. Then it was retitled Let It Be. By that point, the band didn't participate as much as a single unit as they had before. I, Me, Mine, for instance, wasn't recorded with John around. The final straw for Paul was when manager Alan Klein gave producer Phil Spector the session tapes to remix for the Let It Be album. Not only did Spector remix them, he edited and added instruments, creating his wall of sound technique for The Long and Winding Road, which was something that McCartney could not live with. That pushed McCartney's final button. On April 10th, 1970, just 1 week before he was to release his first solo album, McCartney announced the breakup of the band. In a very strange question and answer statement that he released to the press, he didn't say that the band had officially broken up, but he sure did dance around it, and he danced with that subject an awful lot. For example, to answer the question, quote, "Do you foresee a time when Lennon-McCartney becomes an active songwriting partnership again?" End quote. McCartney flat out said, no. About 5 weeks later, in an interview with Rolling Stone magazine, John Lennon responded, quote, "He can't have his own way, so he's causing chaos. I put out 4 albums last year, and I didn't say an effing word about quitting," end quote. There were still some business partnerships to deal with, which continue to this very day, but the group as a whole was done. There were times when they appeared on each other's solo projects and concerts, but never as a complete group. John and Paul would have a famous meeting at John's New York apartment to finally clear the air some years later. Ironically, that was also the night that producer Lorne Michaels of Saturday Night Live offered live on the show a reward for getting the band back together. John and Paul thought about going down to the studio, which was only a 10-minute taxi ride away, as a joke, but they opted out. 1 week later, George Harrison did show up on the show to collect. In a skit, Lorne told him that the deal was actually for all 4 Beatles, not just one, and Harrison was mockingly dejected. Of course, fate would ensure that the Beatles would never get back together again physically, as John Lennon was assassinated on December 8, 1980, at the age of 40. However, the 3 remaining Beatles would get back together. For the making of their Beatles anthology box set and documentary on the band, they took 2 vocals that John had sung on a couple of unreleased songs, finished the tracks, and released them in the box set. Those songs were Real Love and Free as a Bird. The video for Free as a Bird is a haunting tribute to the band's entire career. The 3 remaining Beatles would get back together for the last time on November 12, 2001. At that point, Harrison was dying of cancer, which had started in his throat and then had spread to include a brain tumor and lung cancer, all of which he blamed on his smoking. 3 weeks later, on November 29, 2001, George Harrison passed away from cancer at the age of 58. When Paul McCartney publicly announced that the Beatles were no more on April 10th, 1970. Next, Marian Anderson was a famous 20th century classical music singer who was born on February 27, 1897 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. She first got noticed in 1925 at the age of 28 when she won a singing competition that was sponsored by the New York Philharmonic. From there, she played throughout most of America, including a concert in 1928 at Carnegie Hall in New York City. In 1929, Anderson received a Rosenwald Fellowship to study in Berlin, Germany. While in Europe, she met and became good friends with famed composer Jean Sibelius, who wrote a lot of compositions specifically for her to sing. After that, her career took off, playing to packed houses throughout Europe and receiving praise from many famous people, including even from conductor Arturo Toscanini, who told her that she had a voice, quote, "heard once in 100 years," end quote. Her reception in all parts of Europe and even Russia was such that they gave it the catchphrase "Marian Fever." While she did come back to America to perform at least 70 concerts a year, and while her concerts were always sold out, her personal reception was much different. Why? Because Marian Anderson was black. While people loved to hear her sing, she wasn't allowed to eat in certain restaurants or stay at certain hotels, and not just in the South, since that is a very common misconception that racism and Jim Crow laws were simply a Southern issue. Washington, D.C., despite being the nation's capital, was a segregated city until 1953. The same segregation laws that applied to the much maligned Southern states also applied to D.C. as well, which tends to be forgotten about in history. That meant that black people could not eat in certain restaurants, drink from certain drinking fountains, swim in certain swimming pools that were public, or stay at certain hotels. That included Marian, who, no matter how good she was or how high her stature had become in privileged society, still had issues. She did have people helping her out, though. One of her most famous friends, in fact, was scientist and super genius Albert Einstein, of all people, whom she stayed with whenever she performed in the New Jersey area, which also had a lot of unofficial segregation. This all came to a head in 1939. Famed concert hall Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. was owned by the ultra-conservative group the Daughters of the American Revolution, who had a white performers-only policy. If you were black and wanted to see a concert there, you could, but you had to sit in the very back of the auditorium. Marian Anderson wanted to perform at Constitution Hall on April 9, 1939, and she wanted to do it in front of desegregated audiences, i.e., black and white people together in the same concert hall listening to her sing. Daughters of the American Revolution head Sarah Corbin Roberts said no due to the whites-only performers policy. Marian tried to perform in other auditoriums in the city, but was declined everywhere. The final straw was when the D.C. Board of Education said that she couldn't use an auditorium of a school because the school was a whites-only school. Once word got out about Marian's troubles finding a place to sing in Washington, D.C., that got a lot of people angry. A committee was set up called the Marian Anderson Citizens Committee, which consisted of various civil rights groups, including the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, better known as the NAACP, and the American Federation of Labor. Protests were planned for the next Board of Education meeting. People resigned their memberships in the Daughters of the American Revolution, including First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt. Those resignations, though, were criticized as being hypocritical because while Roosevelt and others put out press releases stating that the Daughters of the American Revolution were wrong about not allowing Anderson to perform, barely any of those very same people criticized the D.C. Board of Education for doing the same thing as the Daughters of the American Revolution. Then the press got involved and really churned up the water, writing on behalf of letting Marian perform, including her hometown newspaper, the Philadelphia Tribune, who wrote, quote, "A group of tottering old ladies who don't know the difference between patriotism and putridism have compelled the gracious First Lady to apologize for their national rudeness," end quote. Finally, with President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt's help, a workaround to the situation was figured out. The National Mall in Washington, D.C. was federal land and thus was not subjected to D.C. segregation laws. The President and First Lady persuaded Secretary of the Interior Harold L. Ickes to let Marian Anderson give a concert on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. Oh, and by persuaded, I mean they told him to do it or else. On Easter Sunday, April 9th, Marian Anderson performed in front of a racially integrated audience of more than 75,000 people in an outdoor concert. Millions more listened to her sing on the NBC radio network. Since no hotels allowed her to stay in D.C., and since apparently the President and First Lady didn't think it was cool for Marian to stay for a night at the White House, mind you, don't know why, Marian stayed with her family in Philadelphia and took the two-hour train trip down to D.C. with her mother and her sister. They did end up staying overnight in D.C. at a private house, but not at the White House because, actually, I have no idea why they weren't able to stay at the White House. You would have figured they would have. Anyway, among the people who attended the concert were Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau, Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black, and Secretary of the Interior Harold Ickes, who introduced Marian. Then, accompanied by her piano accompanist Kosti Vehinen, Marian started the concert with the song "My Country, 'Tis of Thee." She changed a line in the lyrics from "Of thee I sing" to "Of thee we sing." Then she sang the aria "O Mio Fernando," then Schubert's "Ave Maria," then the spirituals "Gospel Train," "Trampin'," and "My Soul is Anchored in the Lord," and then had an encore with the song "Nobody Knows the Troubles I've Seen." There were film cameras there, but they were only there to capture a couple of songs for the movie theater newsreels, so they never recorded the full concert. However, NBC Radio broadcasted the entire concert, and that recording was inducted into the National Recording Registry in 2008. As far as the rest of Marion's career went, she had a very long, illustrious career and was celebrated as her generation's greatest opera singer, becoming a role model for future black opera singing legends such as Leontine Price and Jesse Norman. She received many awards, including a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award, a Congressional Gold Medal, and the Presidential Medal of Freedom, among many others. Marian Anderson passed away on April 8, 1993, at the age of 96. As far as Washington, D.C. went, that was a little bit more complicated. The city finally was forced to get rid of its segregation laws in 1953, but it would still take a couple of decades for things to really change as people found different excuses for not serving black people. Marion was never allowed to perform at any facility that was actually controlled by the Board of Education. However, Marion finally did get to perform at Constitution Hall in 1943 as part of a benefit concert for the American Red Cross, as the nation was in the middle of World War II at that point. Marian Anderson's historic concert on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., on Easter Sunday, April 9th, 1939. Before we go any further, we'd like to tell you about our other podcasts. The Music History Today podcast goes over the daily events in music history and drops daily, including weekends, on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. There's also the Music Halls of Fame podcast, which talks about a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, along with other Music Halls of Fame's museums and walks of fame. The Music Halls of Fame podcast drops every Thursday and can also be found on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to this podcast. Ah, Coachella. That overpriced, overhyped Instagram in the desert. The name conjures up visions of one of the premier music festivals in America. But did you know that it actually came about from a Pearl Jam concert that was held at the Empire Polo Club? Bet you didn't. Pearl Jam was boycotting stadiums that were working with Ticketmaster at the time. Now, for three consecutive weekends out in California, hundreds of thousands of people come to party and see world-famous acts and pay an awful lot of money for it. History is usually made at the festivals, though, with musical acts reuniting or guest singing with other acts. In 2012, though, one event happened that no one had ever seen before, and it is still talked about to this very day. It was during the first weekend of that year's festival. On Sunday night, April 15th, Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre were on stage doing their set. There had been guest cameos already from Eminem, 50 Cent, and Wiz Khalifa, but there were rumors that something big was coming. Snoop and Dre had just performed California Love. People figured that the moment was over. Then the music died down, and a figure appeared in a fog. The music rose. It looked like a hologram of some sort. Then people realized who it was. It was Tupac, who had been shot and killed 15 years earlier. He strutted across the stage, yelled at the crowd, then went into his song Hail Mary. Then he and Snoop Dogg went into their duet, Two of America's Most Wanted. And when that song was done, he stood there and in a burst of light, he was gone. The crowd, of course, went wild. Had they just witnessed a hologram? As it turns out, no. The digital effects were done by Digital Domains. Tupac's crowd greeting was done by a voiceover artist. The actual movement on stage was an optical illusion called Pepper's Ghost. It's named after British professor John Pepper. There's a long explanation about how it's done, but the quick answer is that it involves arranging mirrors and projections to make it seem more lifelike. Pepper's Ghost is normally used at amusement parks, actually. So if you've ever been to Disney World and have ridden the Haunted Mansion or Tower of Terror rides, or gone on the Hogwarts Express at Universal Studios, you've definitely seen Pepper's Ghost. The gimmick had been used in concerts long before Coachella. Madonna used a version of it at the 2006 Grammy Awards in order to make it look like she was performing with the animated band Gorillaz. Even after Tupac, there was an appearance from Eazy-E in Old Dirty Bastard during the 2013 Rock the Bells concert tour. Michael Jackson performed his new song Slave to the Rhythm at the 2014 Billboard Music Awards, despite being dead for 5 years by then. It's even been used in political speeches. Indian Prime Minister Modi was 3D projected at 88 locations during a speech in India. That was actually the second time that he had used that technique. All this brings up certain ethics problems. So, imagine paying money not to see the actual performer performing on stage, but a hologram likeness. I wonder what the fan meet and greet would be like. There have been talks for years of using the technique for a Whitney Houston concert tour, but think about it. You could get the Beatles back together or Nirvana. You could even officially end the East Coast, West Coast hip-hop rivalry by getting Biggie and Tupac on stage performing together. I mean, who wouldn't want to pay money to see that? And guess what? It's already happened because ABBA in London was nothing more than a hologram concert. ABBA wasn't actually there performing. In any event, the reason why the Tupac version stood out above all of the other attempts in concert was because, in a weird way, it seemed the most, well, I guess the only word you could say is real. It was done at the perfect time of the show. It was done in concert and not done on television, so people thought that they were really seeing Tupac and not some TV special effect. Plus, the crowd was probably drunk, high, or both, and really thought they saw Tupac rise from the dead. Regardless, the effect is still talked about, and it's on YouTube. Go check it out. It actually looks like the absolute coolest thing, not gonna lie. When Tupac rose from the dead, sort of, at Coachella, April 15th, 2012. Next. This man's first name is Troyal. He was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1962. He went to college at Oklahoma State University on a track scholarship of all things and graduated with a bachelor's degree in advertising. In the beginning, Troyal was interested in rock and roll, but decided to go into country music instead. Good choice on his part. What made Troyal so popular was that he combined rock and roll with country music, along with putting on some of the most energetic shows ever seen. From his first album, he was a smash success, even though he took almost a decade off at the height of his popularity to raise his children. He's come back stronger than ever, both in touring and recording. He is the biggest country music crossover success story in music history. The Eagles and other 70s artists brought country to rock music. This guy brought rock to country music, and he started a revolution. It was he who started the new country rock invasion of the 90s that continues to this day, with Shania Twain and acts like Florida Georgia Line, Luke Bryan, Morgan Wallen, and Taylor Swift. In fact, these days, it's hard to tell the difference between country and rock, thanks mainly to him. He's won 2 Grammy Awards, which seems shockingly low considering his musical output, 17 American Music Awards, and was the best-selling solo recording artist of the 20th century, even bigger than Michael Jackson. He has released 12 studio albums, 1 live album, 3 compilation albums, 4 box sets, 3 Christmas albums, and has sold over 170 million records. He holds the record for having the most albums sell over 10 million copies, with 7 of them. The Beatles had 6. He is known not by his first name, Troyal, but by his middle name, Garth. Garth Brooks, that is. Garth Brooks' debut album was recorded from the fall of 1987 to the beginning of 1988 at a place called Jack's Tracks Recording Studios. It was released on April 12, 1989. It was a huge hit on the country charts and hit number 13 on the Billboard Albums chart, which was pretty rare at the time for a country album to be charting so high up on the pop charts. He released four songs that became big hits: Much Too Young to Feel This Damn Old, If Tomorrow Never Comes, Not Counting You, and The Dance. The song The Dance caused a little controversy at the time because it suddenly became trendy around that point in time for people in Middle America to commit suicide to the song. The album itself sold over 10 million copies and 13 million copies worldwide. Troyale, Garth Brooks' debut self-titled album, Garth Brooks, released on April 12, 1989. All right, it is time for a couple of honorable mentions this week. First, there are certain songs in music history that, for better or worse, mark the beginning of a genre's move into the mainstream. They're usually never the first song in their genre to be released, but they're the first songs where the mass market decided that the genre was more than just a passing fad. They become anthems, as it were. Take, for instance, Walk This Way by Run-DMC and Aerosmith, which definitely was not the first hip-hop song out there by any stretch of the imagination, but it blew down the doors for rap to finally take its rise into the mainstream. Smells Like Teen Spirit from Nirvana was not the first grunge song, especially since Alice in Chains released their first album less than a year before them. However, it is the song that brought grunge to the masses. On April 12, 1954, Bill Haley and the Comets walked into the Pythian Temple Studios in New York City. The band had earlier been on a ferry going from Philadelphia to New York when it got stuck on a sandbar, so they almost didn't make the recording session. Waiting in the studio for them was producer Milt Gabler, who is actor Billy Crystal's uncle. By the time the band had left the studio, they had recorded what would end up being considered the rebellious anthem for their generation and usher in the rock and roll era. It definitely was not the first rock and roll song released. It wasn't even the first one released by Bill Haley. However, it is the one that, for better or worse, stuck. The song was Rock Around the Clock, which was recorded in New York City on April 12, 1954. Next, we're going to go way back to the Baroque period in classical music. A Christian scholar named Charles Jennens was very unhappy about the rise that secularism was having during that time period, so he decided to do something about it. He wrote a libretto with a bit of Christian propaganda, as it were. He took parts of the Old Testament, put in the life of Jesus Christ, and just for good measure, threw in parts about Judgment Day, everybody's favorite time. He took it to his friend, famed classical composer George Frideric Handel, who wrote the amazing music that goes with the libretto in just 24 days. It was then decided that the piece would first premiere during the season of Lent. Not in a church, though, because that would literally be preaching to the choir. Literally. Nope, he put it in a concert hall in Dublin, Ireland. The thinking there being that if you were in a concert hall instead of church during the Holy Week, then you definitely needed to hear this piece, be saved, and most importantly, get your butt to church, people. A funny thing happened to this piece of music, though. First, the piece did not become popular until just before Handel passed away. Second, although it was originally supposed to be performed every Holy Week, it became something that's performed every Christmas period. Its famous chorus is now used not just for religious settings, but for secular things like TV shows and movies when something miraculous happens, which is probably something that would make good old Charles Jennings roll over in his grave. Hallelujah, hallelujah. Quite possibly the most famous piece of church music ever written, Handel's Messiah, premiered in Dublin, Ireland, not at Christmas time, but during Lent, April 13th, 1742. She is called the Empress of the Blues. She is considered the most popular blues singer of the 1920s and 30s. She influenced not only blues, but also jazz. She is Bessie Smith. Bessie was born on April 15th, 1894 in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Her parents both died by the time she was nine. Her older sister stepped in and raised her, but because of her poor upbringing, Bessie didn't get an education. Instead, her and her brother played music and sang on the streets of Chattanooga in order to make money for the family. When Bessie was a teenager, her brother went away with a traveling performance group. When he came back, he got Bessie an audition with the group. She was hired not as a singer, but as a dancer, because the group already had a singer. They had the legendary Miss Ma Rainey. After a while, Bessie moved on to other groups and made a name for herself on the East Coast and the South between 1913 and 1920. Right around 1920, record labels started looking for black female singers to sign, mainly due to the popularity of the song Crazy Blues by Mamie Smith. By then, as record labels wanted to cash in on black female singers after excluding them for decades, Bessie was ready to dominate blues music. She signed a record deal with Columbia Records in 1923. After that, her career skyrocketed. She appeared on Broadway in one play and also appeared in one film called St. Louis Blues, which itself was inducted into the National Film Registry in 2006. However, she really made her mark with recordings, of which she made almost 200 recordings in her career and became one of the biggest stars of the early recorded music era. She also made her name and living with her appearances in speakeasies and on vaudeville stages. Her first record, Downhearted Blues, with the B-side Gulf Coast Blues, was a smash hit. The song was written by jazz singer Alberta Hunter, with music written by pianist Lovie Austin. Hunter sang the first known version in Chicago with King Oliver's band out there, but then recorded it in 1922. In 1923, Bessie decided to record the song, but she only had Clarence Williams' piano accompanying her. The single sold 780,000 copies in the first 6 months and was eventually selling over 2 million copies. Trust me, neither one of those numbers was no small task in 1923. Smith's version is considered one of the greatest songs of the 20th century, along with being selected for induction into the Grammy Hall of Fame. During her career, Bessie became the highest-paid African-American performer in the world, mainly due to her live performances, as she never really received her proper royalties from her record sales with Columbia Records. Go figure. In fact, she at one time made $2,000 per show, which works out to just over $35,000 in today's money. Bessie enjoyed the luxurious life so much that she traveled America for her gigs in a custom-made railway car, which, when you think about the treatment of African Americans during that time period, was quite remarkable. Her personal life was, well, colorful to say the least. The lady stood at 5'9" tall, weighed 200 pounds, and was tough. Once, according to legend, someone tried to stab her as she performed on stage in Chattanooga, Tennessee. With the knife still stuck in her chest, she chased after the person, then went to the hospital. She performed the next night, too. She also wasn't afraid to punch out a man or a woman or two or three or both. In fact, she knocked out her husband's mistress once Bessie caught them together. Bessie once had the Ku Klux Klan picket one of her shows. Bessie got so angry that she went out to the Klan and yelled at them to leave or she would get angry, and they did not want to see her get angry. The Klan picked up and left. Probably the only wise decision that group of idiots ever did. Bessie was also said to love three things in her life: singing, alcohol, and sex. And she did all three in great abundance. She enjoyed lots of sex, as a matter of fact, with both men, women, and a combination of both from time to time, supposedly. Unfortunately, Bessie passed away on September 26, 1937, at the age of 43, when a car that she was a passenger in collided with a truck. She had more than 10,000 people attend her funeral in Philadelphia. Her influence can be found in a number of singers, especially blues singers, that she left her mark on. In fact, Janis Joplin, not exactly a slouch in blues singing herself, paid for Bessie's headstone when she found out that Bessie was never given a headstone for her gravesite. On the headstone, Janis had the following phrase inscribed on it, quote, "The greatest blues singer in the world will never stop singing," end quote. The Empress of the Blues, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, Bessie Smith, born April 15th, 1894. And that is it for the Music History In-Depth podcast for April 9th through the 15th. Thanks for listening.